This is always the toughest time during a conference or if you're teaching in a school after the lunch hour because, you know, everyone comes in and with a nice full stomach, they have a tendency to want to nap off. And so I'll ask you to do your best to resist that temptation. And I hope that what I have to say to you will be interesting enough that you'll want to. What about all this monkey business? After all, if what I'm saying is correct, that the Christian worldview and the Christian faith is worthy of defense and can be defended, then there ought to be a way to deal with what is probably the greatest and most persuasive icon of anti-biblical and anti-religious scholarship that we find in our culture, and that's the advancing of the theory of evolution as a way of discrediting the Genesis account of man's origin. You'll find in our day and age that people accept the truth of the theory of evolution, and they will accept that it undermines the credibility of the Bible, and they'll do that with very little reflection at all. If you get into a discussion of the theory of evolution as just one example of an attack on the truth of the Christian faith in our day and age, you won't be able, in most cases, I won't say all, obviously, but in most cases, you will not be able to carry on a very detailed discussion with the person who is advancing the theory of evolution, because the vast majority of people who believe in evolution believe it on faith. They have been told that it's true. They've been told that the scientists have demolished the Christian faith. They've been told that any, you know, serious reading of Genesis has been undermined by the research that's been done. And they've just believed that. They have not looked into it. They have not read. They usually don't even know the vocabulary, the terminology, and the major issues in the debate. In fact, when I run into somebody who blithely proposes to me, well, that evolution has really kind of destroyed the credibility of the Bible, I always say, well, I've got an easy one on my hands now. Because anybody who would say that is not familiar with the literature. You see, it's the very idea that you can just take that for granted that indicates to me that I have someone who's being naive. But I'm not going to be responding just to those who are naive about evolution in this lecture. I'm going to be trying to deal with the theory itself and demonstrate to you that you can answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own conceit. I'm already aware that some of you are going to get a little bit lost in the details of some of the counter evidence that I'm going to present to you this afternoon. And so I'm going to tell you ahead of time, if you get to a place where I'm talking about some things and you've just forgotten your high school science and this is a bit over your head, please, you know, lay back for a while, but don't tune out completely, because those illustrations you can go and do a little more research and read about, but I want you to stay with me in the lecture. What I essentially want to show to you this afternoon is that those who hold to the theory of evolution do not, by any stretch of the imagination, hold to it because of its scientific credentials. There are plenty of people who are strongly committed to the theory of evolution, and plenty of them are scientists. And plenty of these scientists are very brilliant men and accomplished in their fields. Nothing that I've taught you today takes any of that away. What I am telling you, though, is that what these men have accomplished in their fields, they cannot account for given their view of the world, given their view of God and man and how we know what we know and so forth. So I'm not saying that unbelievers are blithering idiots. I'm saying that if what they said about the world and about themselves was true, they'd be blithering idiots. And so the foolishness of unbelief is seen in that people cannot make sense of the world given what they say about it. And so their accomplishments are all testimony to the fact that they already know the living and true God. As Romans 1 tells us, all men know God. They live in God's universe and they can function in some limited ways in a successful fashion in God's universe because they know Him. But they will not give thanks to God. They will not honor His name. And that's what leads their reasoning into foolishness. They can't make sense of what they know so well, Because in order to make sense of the world, in order to make sense of human freedom and dignity, moral absolutes, scientific induction, the uniformity of nature, the laws of logic, you would have to have the Christian worldview. So the point when we get done today is going to be made with respect to evolution and creation. I'm not going to try to argue that evolutionists never do any good science. Of course, their view of man's origin is not science at all. It's fairy tale stuff. But that isn't to say they can't do good work in other ways or that they aren't brilliant men. But the theory of evolution is not brilliant. The theory of evolution is utterly discredited. And anybody who knows the field is aware of that. I'm going to try to illustrate that to you, and I'm going to do something I don't ordinarily do in my lectures on evolution. I'd like to follow a particular article. I'm going to be bringing in some of my own material as well, but I think it would be very educative for you to follow a particular article that's been written on the theory of evolution, and the reason for that will become apparent by the time we're done. I have an author here, his name is D.J. Tice, T-I-C-E, who has written a moderately popular summary of the debate in creation-evolution. And he is not a creationist. In fact, he ridicules literalists who want to go to the book of Genesis. And he says, don't we know that those aren't the options? That's not plausible. But on the other hand, he says we have to admit Darwinian evolution isn't plausible either. And at the end, after he's rehearsed these things that I'm going to go over with you, he'll end up saying, we've got to hold on to the theory of evolution, but it's going to have to be something other than what Darwin has taught us. And that is going to be the lesson for the afternoon. The experience of this particular writer who tells us the problems of the theory of evolution very well. Before I begin, using not only the material that Tice will indicate, but also material that I use in my popular lectures on evolution, I think it would be helpful to note, when I think of evolutionists, my mind runs to the White Queen of Alice in Wonderland. Remember, the White Queen practiced believing three impossible things before breakfast. This is what the White Queen does. As the day begins, you've got to get into the habit of believing three things which are impossible. To be an evolutionist, you need to believe the impossible. Not just the improbable, the unlikely, or the poorly supported from the scientific evidence, but the impossible. The theory of evolution is itself internally incapable of being supported by the scientific evidence. And the attempt to use it, the attempt to use scientific evidence to support it, has come to grief over and over and over again. It will be helpful for you to know what the theory of evolution is. I know the term is thrown out there all the time, but I'm going to make a couple things clear. I am talking now about what is called macroevolution. The idea that one species adapts into a completely different species over time through gradual mutations in order to better fit into its environment. Macroevolution. No one is talking about microevolution, the development within species lines. In fact, nobody that I know, either religious or anti-religious, has ever disputed microevolution. Everyone grants that, you know, sometimes there are changes in a particular species or in a particular region of the world within a species, you can see alterations over the years. That's no problem. Both creationists and what are called evolutionists can accommodate that. The real issue is whether you can account for all the variety of the species we have today on the assumption that they all came from a primal parent, which shouldn't even call a parent, but from a certain living organism that develops into all the variety of living organisms that we have today. And can believe that there was a prebiotic phase of evolution where before life was here, chemicals accidentally, coincidentally, by chance, came together and life was formed. Now, if you believe that, you're a macroevolutionist. You believe in prebiotic evolution and the development from an early life form into all the diversity that we see today. So that from the very same molecules that are alive, I'm going to dispute whether you can ever get living molecules in this way, but from the very first living molecules, you get cabbages and giraffes and human beings. Okay? That's going to be a real doozy of a theory that can accommodate that. That you have the same components under the same circumstances that lead to the vast diversity between a cabbage and a giraffe and a human being. So, let's see if evolution can accomplish that. Or do you have to believe three impossible things every morning in order to maintain your evolutionary faith? Most people don't know the history of the theory of evolution. As a philosopher and as a defender of the Christian faith, it's been something of a specialty for me. I'm quite interested in that subject. So let me briefly indicate to you, the theory of evolution didn't begin with Charles Darwin. Theory of evolution goes way, way back. There were theories of evolution among the ancient Greek philosophers, and indeed among the earliest, the Milesian Greek philosophers. Anaximander had a theory of evolution where life, you know, came from the ocean, from primitive fish, and so forth. Theory of evolution has been advanced by others. Charles Darwin's grandfather wrote a poem that talks about gradual development and descent from primary forms to all the diversity that we have today. So the theory of evolution is nothing new. What is it that Charles Darwin added? In 1859, when he published his book, The Origin of Species, what Darwin added was a theory about how such a thing could have happened. How could the vast diversity of living things have come from primary living organisms? How could things which were originally the same have exploded into this plethora of diversity that we see in the world? Men wanted to believe that for years. Men preferred to believe that for years over against the account given to us in the Bible that it's the intelligence and beauty and wisdom of God that's displayed in the diversity of life forms in the world. That God created all these things at the very beginning. And that their origin, if you want to talk about it, is not natural but supernatural. Their origin goes back to the mind and wisdom of God. People not wanting to believe that the origin of all things is God have wanted to believe there's a natural account for the similarities and diversities that we see among living things in the world. But no one knew how to account for that. Charles Darwin stood up and said, I've got it. It's natural selection. Here's how it works, or if you will, the survival of the fittest. Evolution has taken place by means of living organisms adapting to their environment. Somehow life began on this planet billions of years ago, and single cell life in the sea developed over time, eventually came on the land, and there developed further. So that over billions of years, there was descent with modification. Descent with modification. Organisms vary according to the genetic mixing that takes place when there's sexual reproduction. Not only is there genetic mixing through sexual reproduction, there are random mutations that enter into the genetic components of life. And so mutations take place, different combinations of genetic material are brought together, and so you get changes within the life form of the previous generation to the life form of the offspring generation or generations. And now, on average, as these changes take place, on average, not always, but it's a general trend that when these changes take place, those changed organisms that are better adapted than their fellow organisms to live, better adapted to the circumstances of life, survive longer, and because they survive longer, they leave more offspring. And so there is, as we say, differential reproduction among the various types of organisms within a species, and that which leaves the most offspring tends to carry the line of history. So let me put it all together for you. According to Darwin, and with modifications today for differential reproduction being built into neo-Darwinianism, according to the Darwinian model, you have natural selection taking place in that mutations and different genetic combinations come about, and those organisms better adapted are going to survive and leave more offspring. And so that's where we get all the diversity that we do. That's the theory of evolution. Let's now take a look at it and see whether it's plausible, either philosophically and logically on the one hand, or even scientifically on the other. Natural selection is, of course, the explanatory mechanism that Darwin and the neo-Darwinists use today to account for everything that we see. The problem with the theory of natural selection is not only has it not been proven, and there's a great counter-evidence to it, in point of fact and logically, it could not be proven. Natural selection is not a scientific theory subject to either verification or falsification. I know that's going to sound surprising to many of you because if you studied in the university, you've been told natural selection has been demonstrated over and over again. Well, something's been demonstrated, but it's certainly not natural selection. It's not survival of the fittest. And I'm going to now speak according to my field of expertise. I'm going to speak logically to you about this. Look at the contours of the theory or the nature of the theory itself. I'm going to go back to my air blackboard here, okay? Allegedly, we have, according to the evolutionary hypothesis, two versions of a life form. They're closely related. They're in the same species, but one is a mutation of the other, or in some way there's been a genetic difference that comes about. Let's say that we have two wolves, just to give you some concrete illustration. And one of the wolves is a mutation from a primal stock and has stronger hindquarters than the other one. So you have two life forms, here wolves, and one's been born with stronger hindquarters than the other. Now the question that we have to ask is the stronger hindquarters of the one wolf something that makes it more fit for its environment? Now, can anyone here answer that question? I mean, it'd be, in one sense, better to just to have X and Y up here, and then I say, okay, you have a variation between X and Y. Can you tell me if that variation makes the organism more fit for its environment? Well, you'd say, well, it's just X and Y, Dr. Bonson. How could we tell you exactly? You can't say whether X or Y are more fit until what? You find out what X and Y are and how X and Y fare in their environment. But let's go back to the wolf illustration. Is it better for a wolf to have stronger hindquarters or not? Now, if you start out, this seems to be intuitive for most people. Oh, yeah, because a wolf that has stronger hindquarters is going to run faster. And then, on average, such wolves with that mutation are going to get to the kill faster than others. They're the ones who are going to always have their stomachs full. They're not going to starve. They're more likely to have more offspring. And that's going to be the future for the wolf, is that is going to be the more fit. But you know, anybody who studied animal behavior would never make the mistake of jumping in and answering that question. Because it is also possible that when you have a mutation like a wolf with stronger hindquarters, that the greater muscular development of the back legs puts a strain upon the heart, which has not changed to accommodate that, and therefore the smaller heart of the mutated wolf is going to pass out because of the strain of the back legs. And so then, that mutation isn't something that helps you to survive. It actually kills off that strain of wolf because of the heart attacks that they have. So now, how are we going to decide? Evolutionary theory says, and this is supposed to be a scientific hypothesis, evolutionary theory says two organisms exist together in the same environment. One is a mutation of the other, has some characteristic that's different. And if that characteristic makes it more fit, then that organism we predict will survive by leaving more offspring. Well, you can't test the theory, though, until you find out whether the organism with the mutation is the more fit or the other. Now, what determines whether the organism is more fit than the other? Well, you have to watch them and see which one survives, don't you? If the wolf dies of a heart attack on average more times than not, then that doesn't help it survive. If it gets to the kill more often and doesn't die of a heart attack, that makes it more fit to survive. The only way you could determine which organism was the most fit is to find out which one survives. Now, if you're all sitting there saying, yeah, so what? I guess you haven't noticed that we've completed the loop. Because the theory says the fit can be predicted to survive. But the theory also, by just logical examination, the theory cannot tell you which are the more fit that you predict to survive until you find out which ones survive. In which case, Darwin's survival of the fittest, by logical analysis, dissolves into the survival of the survivors. Those organisms which survive are the most fit to survive, is what Darwin is saying. Well, there is really nothing profound about that. So A is A, B is B, and survivors are survivors. That's all we're being told. That's not a scientific theory. It's not even a good speculative theory. It's a completely untestable theory. It's a theory which is true by definition when you understand what fitness is and what survival is all about and the way they are related by evolutionists. And yet, week after week, month after month, semester after semester, we have students being taught from high school through college and university and graduate school that this is what Darwinism and neo-Darwinianism has accomplished. We now have a mechanism for evolution, survival of the fittest. The very idea of survival of the fittest is under attack philosophically and has been for 25 years. And is being attacked by those who do scientific investigation as well. Since differential reproductive success is the very engine that drives the Darwinian theory of evolution, it would seem that the one quality that a living organism could gain, the one quality above all the others that would make it have a favored position for survival, that one quality would be early, abundant, and simple reproduction. Let me say this again. Neo-Darwinianists tell us that those mutations of a living organism that leave the most organisms are the ones that are going to survive. In that case, the one quality that would make an organism especially fit for survival is that it bears its young early, it bears plenty of young, and it does so through a simple method of reproduction. And so scientists are asking today, why then has evolution moved from simple, abundant reproduction that's found among bacteria toward complicated and sparse reproduction that is more typical of higher animal forms? On the very theory of evolution, evolution should not develop in the direction of sparse reproduction, more complicated reproduction. It should move in the direction of greater numbers of organisms being reproduced and through the simplest method possible. Do I need to illustrate this for you? You take some amoeba, you take some bacteria, you put them in a petri dish, and boy, they go wild. You know, cell division, reproduction of all sorts of things, on and on and on and on. You take the most prolific dog running around in your neighborhood, and it won't come anywhere close to the first generation of what bacteria do in reproduction. You say, yeah, so what? Dogs and bacteria are different. Well, but the theory says dogs came from bacteria. But the theory also says what drives survival of the fittest is differential reproduction. Therefore, those organisms that reproduce faster, early, and without complication, they should be the ones that survive, and there shouldn't be greater complexity. So you see, evolutionists cannot account for what we call the birds and the bees. And I want to embarrass anybody here today, but you see, I've always wondered, and when I do this lecture for college students and high school students, I like to emphasize this. Most of them like to think about sex anyway. I say, can you explain to me how the evolutionary theory can credibly get from reproduction by cell division to reproduction by copulation? I'm just waiting for some evolutionist to step forward and explain that to me. Why would there be the development of genitalia in any organism, much less human beings, for reproduction? That's not the easiest way to reproduce. Anybody who knows biology knows that you get much faster and greater abundant offspring from non-copulatory reproduction. Why then did it develop at all? And if it developed for other reasons, this is always the cop-out evolutionists have, well, there must be other reasons for the genitalia that developed. If they developed for other reasons, why is it that they became useful for sexual reproduction? And, pardon me, whose idea was that? For animals to get together and copulate. The theory of evolution on its own terms breaks down. It's really a silly theory. It's philosophically discredited already, I've shown you that, but it's scientifically discredited as well. It's really hard to see, if I can quote my author here, it's very hard to see that human beings are any more fit than bacteria if the measure of fitness is leaving genes, that is, having a lot of offspring. Bacteria have a lot of offspring. They should be the most fit. So where did human beings come from on this theory? Another problem that theory of evolution has with its view of survival of the fittest is that it depicts organisms as constantly adapting to their changing environments. But if organisms are always adapting to changing environments so that those that are less fit die out, then at any time throughout history, because you see, there's nothing to turn off the clock of evolution or the flip the switch of evolution. Evolution's an ongoing thing. At any time in history, in any particular living environment, you should have organisms that are more adept and those that are less adept. Those that have fit in better and those that haven't fit in. And those that haven't fit in are going to adapt or they're going to die out. That's the story that we've been told. Well, then where are the creatures in the world today that are in need of adaptation? Evolutionists are embarrassed by this. It's almost as though the theory of evolution is a story about history, and then we ended it at some point, and now everything's fully adapted and there shouldn't be any more else going on. Well, there should be. We should see continuing refinements to an environment. Where are those creatures that were in need of adaptation? And moreover, given this theory, which is more likely? If you have a living organism that's not as adept for a particular environment as another, why is it that that kind of species doesn't change its area of residence rather than sit around and die out or adapt? If you know anything about animal behavior, animals tend, and living organisms tend, whether they have animation or not, tend to move toward an environment to which they are more fit rather than to adapt to the environment that's adverse to them right now. That's an embarrassment to the theory of evolution. Now, you need to know some of these things so that when people say, well, we all know the theory of evolution, that just ain't so. Philosophers know that it's a bogus theory logically. And those who know that there is abundant embarrassment. The theory just doesn't fit what we all accept to be the facts. And there are just so many features of plants and animals that don't seem explainable as advantages. You see the variations between various plants and animals. You have to ask yourself, this really came about by the survival of the fittest, by adaptation, making it more fit for the environment? If that theory were true, why is it that many plants have made themselves dependent upon only one species of insect for pollination? Ask yourself, does that make it more likely to leave offspring if it develops through the evolutionary mechanism in such a way that only one species of insect can pollinate it? No, the plant would be better off to have any number of insects come by to pollinate it if differential reproduction is what's driving this thing and those that don't have high degrees of reproduction are dying out. Tice uses as his example a particular Australian orchid that has evolved a structure that looks like the female of a certain wasp species. And that attracts, of course, the more amorous males of the species. But now, wouldn't that plant have done better not to evolve to attract just that particular kind of wasp? Why not evolve in such a way that it would attract any number of insects of various sorts? That increases the likelihood of survival. What the plant has done is actually evolved to a point where it is less likely to survive. He uses another example that's somewhat humorous. He speaks of a distasteful variety of lily that has evolved the odor of carrion. And the reason, according to the theory, is this plant has evolved to have the odor of carrion better to appeal to blowflies, which are the only insect that will pollinate that plant. And they do so because they're attracted to the foul smell of the plant, thinking that they're landing on rotting flesh. Well, that's pretty amazing, adaption like that, isn't it? Plants adapting to the point where it's very difficult for them to reproduce, rather than adapting in a way that makes differential reproduction to be maximized for them. What possible advantage, Tice says, can there be in a flower's limiting itself to one pollinator? It would seem more advantageous to appeal to many pollinators, indeed as many other flowers do, with far simpler adaptations. And then he goes on to ask another question. Given this particular theory of natural selection, it's unclear why there is such a numbing variety of flowers. And I enjoyed reading this. I have for years talked about my experience of seeing this butterfly museum. Actually, it's not a museum because there's living butterflies there too, in Atlanta a number of years ago. And it's just awesome to see not only the beauty and the color, but the vast diversity of butterflies around the world and so forth. Well, he uses the same point about flowers. And he says, since all of these designs seem to work, in what way are all of they supposed to be advantages? I mean, why is there such a wide variety of butterflies? Why such a wide variety of flowers if evolution is to be believed that the fittest survive? Are we going to say that every single one of those varieties is fitter than others in some particular way? We have no idea what that would be. Many varieties of bees die when they sting, and yet stinging persists among bees. Now, how can that be if natural selection rules? If natural selection makes those things which are fit for survival to be the survivors, then why is it that bees which sting and die continue to exist? They should have died out a long time ago. If birds evolved from reptiles because of the superb advantage of flight, How are we to explain creatures who made that incredible transition without bothering to cash in on the advantage? Why is it that we have birds that don't fly? The whole point is flying is supposed to make you more fit for your environment. That's an advantage for survival. Why then did certain birds evolve that don't fly at all? You see, the survival of the fittest is just a preposterous, after-the-fact, imaginary theory, which is logically deficient and scientifically deficient. Why do unfit forms of a biological organism thrive side by side with those which are supposed to be more fit? Many female mosquitoes are bloodsuckers. You know that. And they suck blood to take it back to nurture their young. And yet there are other female mosquitoes that are not bloodsuckers. Well, I mean, why is it that one that's more fit for survival, you can get the blood to take care of your young, continues to live side by side with one that's not a blood-sucking mosquito at all? Mammals presumably evolved from reptiles because, we are told, this is what the theory says, the mammalian lifestyle is so dramatically advantageous. If it weren't, there wouldn't be any mammals. The whole engine of evolution is toward that which is more advantageous. But if mammals and their lifestyle are so much more advantageous to the environment than reptiles, why do we still have reptiles at all? You see, the survival of the fittest just brings more questions to be answered than it answers. And it doesn't have logically strong credentials to begin with. But there's something even further wrong with the theory of evolution as it appeals to survival of the fittest as the engine for differentiation and development throughout history. As Tice puts it, if some features are hard to explain through natural selection because they don't look much like advantages, others, like the eye, are unmistakably advantageous, but only when they are complete. What's the advantage of half an eye? Zero. What's the advantage of half a heart? Zero. What's the advantage of half-developed lungs? Zero. Half-developed livers? Zero. Is it possible for an organism to survive that has a heart that doesn't have lungs? Zero. Is it possible for a heart to survive that doesn't have a liver to purify the blood? Zero. And so what you have to have is not the gradual incremental development of hearts and lungs and livers, and then presto, all in one generation, you get an organism that has a fully developed heart, fully developed lungs, fully developed liver. It just doesn't happen because the theory says it has to happen gradually. But if it has to happen gradually, then you'll never get a heart that develops, never get lungs that develop, and never get livers that develop, which is to say you'll never get mammals. The theory is inherently impossible. And not surprisingly, we find that in our day and age, those who have led the way in defending the theory of evolution are giving up gradualism. That isn't to say they're willing to go back and affirm creation, but what they want to do is they want to affirm something that looks like creation, but then give it a secular name. And I'd like to illustrate that from the fossil record itself, because this is perhaps the greatest hoax when it comes to the scientific support for evolution. The leading defender of evolution, in my estimation, in our culture, I think most people would say this, is Stephen Jay Gould, a paleontologist who tells us that we have to admit that it's the trade secret of paleontology that there's no evidence for evolution or gradualism in the fossil record. No evidence. Not little evidence, not evidence that's being exaggerated. Gould, the leading evolutionist and a leading paleontologist, says there is no evidence in the fossil record. The fossil record shows us stability of species And the fossil record shows us that complex forms appear suddenly in the fossil record, not with transitional forms. The record doesn't show constant gradual change in organism. It shows species that stay almost exactly the same throughout their existence over, allegedly, millions of years. And when radical new forms appear, they appear without transition. They appear suddenly. Now, this conflict between what Darwinian and neo-Darwinian theories would lead us to expect and the actual record of the fossils is not really new. Darwin knew of it himself. Darwin is embarrassed by it. And so he writes in The Origin of Species, "The explanation lies in the extreme imperfection of the fossil record." Boy, that's the sort of thing you want to underline if you're reading, and hold on to that. Darwin says, "My theory would lead us to look for in the fossil record transitional forms." In fact, hundreds and thousands of transitional forms. But the fossil record doesn't support that, doesn't support it at all. And so what does Darwin say? Well, then the fossil record be hung. And you'll find that that's what evolutionists have done for years. Evolutionists will depend on the fossil record when they think they can make it look like evolution. And so you've all seen museum displays of the evolution of the horse, for instance. By the way, a leading evolutionist in our day who knows better says of that particular thing that it's so speculative that scientists who present it ought to be embarrassed. But nevertheless, when evolutionists have what they think is a development chain that they can show, then the fossil record is quite reliable as far as they're concerned. But then when the fossil record doesn't support them, they say the fossil record be hung. You know? Those of you who are watching the O.J. Simpson case are probably getting a taste of this sort of thing. You're getting it from both sides, so don't think I'm taking any position on this. But you see, that's what lawyers do, right, Jeff? Lawyers emphasize this particular line of evidence if it's favorable to their client, and when that same line of evidence is disfavorable, then they say, oh, yeah, well, that's not so important. Evolutionists have their minds made up in advance. This is not something supported by observational fact. They only interpret their observations according to what they want them to prove. Evolutionists are willing to admit that. Stephen Jay Gould has now developed a theory many of you have heard of punctuated equilibria. The theory of punctuated equilibria goes like this. Evolution did not take place constantly over the eons in a gradual fashion. Rather, evolution takes place in very short bursts of energy. So there's great evolutionary change for a short period, and then long, we're talking like thousands, millions of years of unchanged stuff, and then a burst of evolutionary change, then millions of years. And because you see, if that's the way it happened, then what you'd find in the fossil record is what we've already said. You'd have these gaps between the various forms. But you see, I'm a philosopher. I'm a logician. I don't go out there and dig in the dirt. I'll let the other guys dig up the fossils and talk about all that. I'm just watching the way the theory works. And do you see the way the theory works? It goes like this. I believe in evolution. The fossil record doesn't support gradual evolution. Therefore, I'll revise the theory of evolution so that there wouldn't be any evidence in the fossil record to begin with. Pretty nifty. So the evidence for my theory is there can't be any evidence for my theory. Not bad then, because when I say, hey, there's no evidence for your theory, you say, exactly, that's what I expect. I'd expect there'd be no evidence. That's a winner in Las Vegas, I'm telling you. If you don't have to have anything to substantiate your theory, and that's what substantiates it, well, then you've won in advance, haven't you? Now let me quote for you what Stephen Jay Gould actually says from Paleobiology, 1977. Gould says, the general preference that so many of us hold for gradualism is a metaphysical stance embedded in the history of Western cultures. It is not a high-order empirical observation induced from the objective study of nature. This from the leading evolutionist in American culture. Why do we prefer gradualism, that is, some kind of theory of evolution? He says it is a metaphysical stance. Many of you will not be familiar with the word metaphysics. Metaphysics is the division of philosophy that studies the nature of reality. Okay? And so if I can translate for you, he says, our preference is a philosophical stance, a metaphysical stance embedded in the history of Western cultures. It is not a high-order empirical observation. That is an observation of our senses going to the evidence of what's out there in the world. It is not a high-order empirical observation induced from the objective study of nature. Why am I an evolutionist? He goes, it's not because nature requires me to be an evolutionist. I'm an evolutionist because that's my philosophical preference. I really hope you've been listening to the lecture today, not that you would memorize all the counter evidences. There's a place for that. When I talk to evolutionists, I usually throw out a few of these ringers just so that it'll humble them and quiet them down long enough to listen to what's really going on. I'm not against using that kind of evidence. But you need to understand that it's not a battle over evidence, ultimately. It's a battle over philosophies. And the better evolutionists, the ones that are acknowledged as the leaders in the field, they admit it. Let me come back to this article that I said that I wanted to summarize for you and that I've been looking at here as I've been lecturing by D.J. Tice. I told you, Tice presents a number of embarrassing pieces of counter evidence for the theory of evolution. One that I haven't mentioned yet that I want to get to and I'll mention right now is that the theory of evolution, the neo-Darwinian theory of evolution, seems to perform an incredible task of explaining two things which are contrary to each other simultaneously. What he points out is that natural selection is supposed to be what accounts for the preservation of the fittest species within a particular line of living organisms. Natural selection accounts for the preservation of the species. That all sounds well and good, because once something evolves to the place where it's most fit for survival, then, of course, it stays on. It is preserved. Okay, now pretend I haven't just said that. That's one part of the secular philosopher's lecture. But another part of the lecture is, well, now how do we get all the diversity and all the change? And the professor says, oh, that's natural selection. Natural selection drives all this diversity and the development and the evolution among species. Well, once again, the philosopher stands back and he says, details aside, just look at this theory. Now, you're telling me that natural selection accounts for the preservation of species and the evolution of species simultaneously. Again, that's a winner in Las Vegas. You can't lose for winning on that one. So, if someone gives evidence of change, you say, natural selection. But then if somebody says, oh, well, here's evidence of preservation, you say, oh, natural selection. Because, see, the fact of the matter is, we note that most species don't change. In fact, there would appear to be an inner dynamic. We're learning more about genetics all the time from DNA studies and so forth. There seems to be an inner regulation on the amount of change that's possible within a living organism. And so people will say, oh, well, that's what evolution brought about. That preservation of the species is due to it finding its niche in the environmental ordering of things. But on the other hand, the changes that do take place, the mutations and so forth, that too is supposed to be natural selection that's driving change. So it drives the change and it drives the fixity of species. Well, which is it? In philosophy, when you can contradict yourself, when you're allowed opposite qualities, you can prove anything. And you will find, if you've studied this, I don't care whether it's with the degree of interest that I've shown, but if you study it at all, you will notice that evolutionists come up with any kind of conclusions because their theory is inherently contradictory. It's inherently contradictory, and therefore it could prove anything. It can accommodate any kind of evidence. I think you'd be interested in a quotation from a leading evolutionist about the nature of preservation of species and why that takes place, of evolution supposed to constantly be bringing about diversity and change. James Hankin writes, "We don't know whether developmental regulation is analogous to the regulation evident each spring." That is, you'll see how plants begin to burst into bloom and animals begin to procreate and so forth. But at springtime, but then the mechanism doesn't do that all the time. He says, we don't know whether developmental regulation is analogous to that or not. And we don't know how regulatory genes work or exactly what they're capable of. A great deal of work needs to be done in this field. In fact, most of the work remains to be done in this field. Yes. But you see, that's what's supposed to explain the origin of species so that we don't have to go running to the Genesis account and be, you know, Sunday school dithering idiots for thinking that God did it all. And then if it is going to be something that changes species in burst of energy according to punctuated equilibria, what is it that causes the burst of change? Now, we have a burst of change view also. It's called creation. And on one day, there was a burst of change. And on a second day, a burst of change. On a third day, a burst of change. We call that creation. Evolutionists want to go back now and say, well, there's long periods, and then a burst of change, long periods, a burst of change. But it's not God. Oh, no, we don't want creation. No, no, it's got to be evolution. You say, okay, fine. What causes the burst of change? So, leading evolutionist Eldridge says, quote, new species arise when something happens. Chromosomal change or something that prevents two groups within the same species from mating. Then you get a tremendous amount of anatomical change. You say, excuse me, professor, could you back up and repeat that for me? What is it then accounts for the origin of species? New species arise when something happens. And then all kinds of anatomical changes come about. Now, I'm quoting leaders in the field to you. Did you know that? Were you aware of how shoddy the evidence for evolution is? How poor its philosophical credentials are? Of course you didn't. And you didn't because we live in a day and age where the high priests of academia have bamboozled vast majorities of their students. Thousands and thousands of students to believe, well, evolution's scientific, creation, that's religious, that's mythical, that's just wishful thinking. Anybody who knows the nature of the debate knows that evolution is not a scientific theory, it is philosophically and scientifically discredited, and that in our day and age, those who want to hold on to evolution are still waiting for an answer better than Darwin's. They want to hold to natural development and they have no explanation for it. You say, well, why don't they just go back to creation? And that's what leads me back finally to my article by Tice. Because here I'm reading a man who writes well and who has amassed both philosophical and scientific evidence against evolution, and yet he says we can't go back to Genesis. It's a long article. I've read it many times, scoured it, read it backwards, tried to, you know, backward mask it, find something in here. What is the explanation? Why can't we go back to Genesis? You know what it comes down to? He goes, because the alternative to evolution is just not plausible. I'm not kidding you. That's what he says. It's just not plausible. Now, we need something more than Darwin, but we sure don't need Moses. That's what he's telling us. Oh, why not? Because it's just not plausible. Now, plausible means believable. It has something that's credible about it. And here we have a man who writes, evolution's got all these problems, Darwinian evolution, but we've got to hold on to evolution. That is a better theory than the opposite, which is creationism. Because the opposite theory, he says, is just not believable. It's just not plausible. And that's the state of the debate. When you talk to somebody who says, I can't believe Christianity, I can't believe the Bible, and one of the main reasons why I can't do it is because of all this monkey business about evolution. We know, because the scientists have told us, we know that man didn't develop directly from the hand of God. He came through a primordial life form, you know, down through the cabbage and whale and giraffes and apes and so forth until we finally got man. We know that. To which you should say, and how do you know that? Why do you believe that? And upon analysis, it will prove to be the case that the evidence that your friend, colleague, appeals to for evolution will be evidence that equally fits into the creationist account of man and his origins. He will not appeal to, I assure you of this, take me at my word, go out and study on your own, you'll find this to be true in experience. There is not one evidence offered by evolutionists that is not equally relevant to the creationist account. It's not a question of what then is out there, it's a question of how you choose to interpret it. Evolution, I told you at the beginning of my lecture, so if I've lost you along the way, tune back in now. Here's the bottom line. Evolution is not a scientific theory. It's not a theory that is fueled by scientific credentials. It is a philosophical, religious view of man and life. And people hold on to it not because of the evidential credentials that it can offer. They hold on to it as a preference because of their religious state of mind, because of the character of their heart. If you don't want to deal with the living and true God, who is so grand, so glorious, so sovereign, so wise and beautiful, as to show us the vast array of what he can do by creating the world in the way that he has, if you don't want to answer to that God, then you'll prefer any kind of exit out. And if evolution offers you that kind of exit, that's what you'll prefer to believe and interpret all the evidence out there in an evolutionary light, even though none of the evidence really supports evolution in a distinctive way, and much of the evidence refutes evolution, and in the end, philosophically, there could be no proof of evolution in the Darwinian sense anyway. I hope you see how this illustrates my second lecture today, because in my second lecture, I taught you three things, didn't I? I taught you that everybody has an ultimate authority. For the evolutionist, that's true too. The evolutionist has an ultimate authority. Obviously, it's not the Word of God. If it was the Word of God, he'd be a creationist, not an evolutionist. And that ultimate authority turns out to authorize itself. It's not supported by further evidence or further considerations. You've got to take that authority on its own say-so. And yet that authority, the theory of evolution, the final philosophical way of looking at things, proves to be self-contradictory and beyond the possibility of proof. It is then nothing more but wishful thinking. It's the desire of man's heart to account for the variety and the diversity in life forms by saying it didn't happen because God is so smart, it happened because nature is so clever. I say that tongue-in-cheek because, you see, the evolutionist basically doesn't get away from God. The evolutionist simply wants to make the natural order his God so that the natural order accounts for diversity and similarity and all the changes that we see about us rather than a transcendent God. What did Paul say in Romans 1? When men suppress the truth in unrighteousness, they end up worshiping the creature rather than the Creator. Thank you.